Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly Podcast, the sibling podcast to the popular weekly classic car title. I'm the staff writer, Jesse Billington, and this week we're back in our Peterborough HQ, the slightly echoey room, and I'm joined by features editor Chris Hope.
Hello.
And editor David Simister.
Good morning.
And gents, how are you? How are the classics? And how did you spend a bank holiday?
Well, important milestone today, not for the MX-5, but for my Toyota Avensis, which this morning on a very dark motorway just outside Skelmersdale, clocked up my 100,000th mile in my ownership. So I bought it with 25,000 miles on the clock. That was way back in 2016, and it's now officially on 125,000 miles. So it's increasingly gaining traction as a kind of a festive of the unexceptional, worthy kind of modern classic. So it does seem to be gaining interest, and I love its bits. It's a great little car, and it does very very noble work ferrying me between the north of England and Classic Car Weekly's offices in Peterborough.
I was going to say, it's doing about 10,000 miles a year, which is impressive going, really, considering we're supposed to have had some quiet years in the middle of that, sort of 2020, 2021. But yeah, it's that's heavy going.
Yeah, the only issues I've had with it, I mean, I had to change a pipe running to the oil reservoir. There was a worn-out ignition barrel. But apart from that, the only issues I've had with it were right during Boris Johnson and the lockdown in 2020. There was a period when, obviously, I wasn't using it and the battery kept going flat. But apart from that... that's my own fault, Boris Johnson's fault, because I wasn't allowed to go anywhere.
Happy to blame Boris for that one. Yes. Yeah, otherwise the rest of it,
sorry, Boris.
Seems to be fairly good Toyota engineering, so
absolutely
to it.
Well, you've been sort of always threatening to sort of do an hour classics piece on the events. It's never quite sure whether it is or isn't sort of suitable for the
maybe you guys can tell us in the comments. Yeah, is the 1998 Toyota Avensis, is it worthy or not?
If you've done 100,000 miles now, I think that's got to be sort of something that you look back on in terms of sort of a retrospective piece sort of thing. So
yeah, it's earned a spot, certainly, as it hits that milestone. And I think 1998, the Jimny was launched in 1998, and I write about that fairly regularly, but that's because it keeps breaking. So at least it keeps breaking, I keep fixing it badly and something else goes wrong, I think, is also part of it. I spent some of the bank holiday weekend reattaching the dashboard once more, because where I'd done the heater matrix on it, I sort of chucked the dashboard back in, and there was one bolt underneath it that turns out the entire vehicle requires to be sort of inserted and tight. Otherwise, the entire thing, it just shakes itself to pieces. But the bolt holds in quite line up properly. It's a very tight sort of alignment. So what I ended up doing was getting the jack out of the boot, a section of scrap piping, and simply winding the jack to force the dashboard back into alignment so I can slot this one bolt in. It's completely eradicated the annoying squeak that had been pervading since I'd done the heater matrix. So it's a job well done. And then, otherwise I spent quite a lot of the bank holiday actually in the workshop, because I had work done on the MG, finally got pistons into the block, sorted out the floating gudgeon pins, because they weren't floating, they were in fact quite stuck.
Oh dear.
So fresh gudgeon pins, and they've now been sort of properly seated within the little ends of the comrades, so we've got that all sorted, going to torque those down tonight. And I'll get to the Mustang in a minute, but Chris, obviously you're here in the Mini today.
Yeah, part next to the Jimny. I'm just going to say, is that the reason why we don't see anything of the Avensis? It's opposite extremes of Japanese reliability that we're dealing with here, sort of thing. So, no, the Mini's good. The Mini's in the car park. It's, coming out about once a week now that the weather's decent. Nice driving to work, even if I'm having to deal with the roadworks on the A1, but some nice back roads on the way there to avoid the roadworks, which is quite nice. It's going to be taking part, fingers crossed, touch wood, in an event end of this month. So the London to Brighton Classic Car Sunday the 31st, isn't it? London to Brighton Classic Car Run. You can tell me a bit more about it, what I've got in sort of stores. So
It's a really good day out, actually. Obviously, start out from Brooklands Museum, you sort of get flagged off, you do a sort of quick loop round the grounds of the museum under the nose of Concord, and then you're sort of off, basically sort of booted out into sort of the lush countryside of southern England. And it's just a really good fun run all the way down to the coast. They sort of arrive at this sort of car show that builds through the day on Madeira Drive, and sort of I think you can, when I checked last night, actually, there were still tickets available to do the run, and you can certainly still buy tickets to take part in the car show at the end as well. £15 to get your car in onto Madeira Drive, so you can be part of that sort of building, sort of show and spectacle there. So it's a grand day out and well worth doing. I've done it in the MG as a driver and as a navigator in James's Polo.
Yeah.
And both times it's been an absolute laugh, to be fair. You really enjoy it. It's a good route.
Well, I've got James joining me, so I've got at least a knowledgeable sort of navigator there. David Zaventis has done 100,000 miles in his ownership. I think I'm lucky if I've done 1,000. So bought June last year. Definitely want to get it serviced before I take part in this. Last night I had it give it a quick check over sort of thing, and it gobbled up a load of oil sort of thing. So I thought I just needed a little top up because it was just a little bit below minimum, but it ended up taking about a quarter of a litre tin sort of thing. So yes, I definitely want to make sure that it's happy with doing that length of journey. It's been to the NEC, it's been to the Birmingham Exhibition Centre. That's about an hour and a half from where I am, so a 3-hour round trip. This is asking a little bit more, so I just want that sort of, you know, safety of knowing that I've given it the once over, checked it, given it a fresh service, made sure that it's ready and raring. I don't want to be the one that breaks down because it's not happened yet, as far as I'm aware. So I don't want to break that tradition. I want to get to Brighton in one piece and hopefully back home again afterwards. So
yeah, I don't want to besmirch it. It's obviously good practice to sort of service it and maintain it and all that. But it's not a challenging run. It's not sort of like arduous road conditions where you're sort of scrabbling over sort of single lane tracks and things. It's not sort of rallying spec. It is like nice, easy going B roads, which is good fun. But on the oil front, I think there's a good chance for me to plug something I picked up actually at Bicester Heritage when I was on there for the scramble, which was having a word with the guys over at it's Vintage Oils, Classic Oils there, and getting some advice on oil for the MG. And they've got a very nice sort of own brew oil, which is very high zinc content and okay. Very good for classic engines, both as a bed-in engine and a long-running sort of oil. So I was able to pick up two cans of that, which is very good. And
other oils are available.
Other oils are available, but this is one that I am sort of encouraged to use by sort of their proprietors. Obviously, you think it's Castrol do a couple of classic ones, but yes. this one is essentially high-grade Valvoline, sort of basically the sort of recipe for Valvoline, sort of really high spec, sort of high zinc content one.
Okay.
But you can't get that in the UK. So they just sort of went, well, we know what goes into it. We'll just make it ourselves.
Still 20W50? Is it still
20W50? Like, so yeah. The same weighting, same sort of constituency, but it's just sort of got that really nice sort of mineral aspect to it, that really nice zinc weighting to it that just helps protect soft shell bearings. So for an MG engine that's prone to spinning bearings, it's prime for my engine, really. But worth sneaking that one in there, because that's a great thing if you're going to be looking at servicing.
Well, more often than not, when I'm driving the Mini, it's sort of spinning at 4,000 revs, if not more sort of thing. So yeah, I think it probably needs that extra sort of care. So if it is A series, just it's the way that they run, isn't it, sort of thing. But yes, I think something that's a little bit more forgiving wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for it. So I'll have a look into that. Thank you.
Has that little extra bit of cushioning to it and just helps keeping it sort of stops it dissipating and getting too thin when it gets hot, as well as other things. Why a lot of people with the MG engines that I've got run the oil cooler, it just stops it going too thin around the sort of bearing shells, and therefore you lose that sort of lubricating protection. But anyway, I was going to mention the Mustang quickly, because it also leads into the lead news story quite nicely, because we had that out on Driver Day. Actually, it was the only classic vehicle in our fleet that made it out for Driver Day, where it immediately developed a misfire, because it's obviously been sitting essentially for 3 years with petrol in the tank. And as soon as it sort of started sucking through a load of stale old petrol, it sort of went, oh, I don't quite like this. So all of a sudden, its lumpy V8 idle became a lot lumpier. So we ended up pumping out about 20 litres of stale petrol from the tank. Because every time we'd taken it out previously, we're just like, oh, we'll chuck 10 litres in it, and that will, because the fuel gauge doesn't work. So the method was always, oh, we'll just stick 10 litres in and that'll be fine.
Yeah.
The problem is, over the years, we just built up sort of like sedimentary rock layers and layers of petrol that have all gone stale over the years. So we pumped all that out, took it down to the forecourt, filled it up with some premium, and it's pretty much cured its sort of misfire. So that's good. I'm now working through all the stale petrol in the Jimny, which that thing will burn anything that's vaguely sort of flammable. Weirdly, the clog iron American V8 in the Mustang is getting picky in its old age as to what it will combust, but the Jimny will get through anything that's sort of close to like 2-star. Filling it up with the E5 seemed to be the sort of the trick that fixed it. And the good news is that E5 is going to be sticking around on four courts for a little bit longer.
Certainly seems to be the way. When E10, which is petrol with up to 10% ethanol in it, was rolled out in 2021, it was always the case that the government said, yes, we'll support it being, you know, the lower E5 petrol, which is up to 5% ethanol, staying on forecourts. Yeah, and you can get it if you go to your petrol station, you fill up with premium unleaded, that will generally be E5. But they only said they would support that for 5 years, which means that next year, 2026, it's due for a review. Government haven't said anything just yet, but it's likely going to be the case. But the good news is we've spoken to the petrol retailers, and the feedback we've been getting from them is actually it's not just classic car owners who are using E5. It tends to be sort of if you've got a brand new Subaru or a Porsche or a Lamborghini or something like that. Mm. Those guys, even with like brand new performance cars, they tend to be using E5. So actually, it's making up around 10% of the petrol fill-ups in the UK, which is actually really good news.
That is, yeah.
It backs our industry up, and it means that all these cars that sort of generally sort of made before 2000, which are more likely to need lower ethanol petrol, because there's the demand for it, it's more likely to remain on the forecourts because there's the demand for it.
That's always my worry when I sort of go to my petrol station is that it's just a single pump with the super unleaded sort of thing. It's like if that disappears, that's going to be a long drive to find something else.
Yeah.
I think around my way, we seem to be quite fortunate. I know our big Tesco still stocks its sort of Tesco premium on the forecourts alongside sort of regular E10. And I know the Shell just up the road at the 101 also has both grades of fuel. So I think it might just be sort of one of those weird regional quirks that it sort of depends on the demand in your area as to whether people sort of keep stocking it. Because it's one of those things that, again, prices fluctuate because it depends on when your local petrol station is able to buy its petrol. And also it seems to be sort of whether or not your area consumes a lot of E5 or E10. So it's sort of one of those things, whether you fall in the catchment area of E5 petrol.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had a problem picking up E5. And generally speaking, I tend to run the Toyota on E10 because it's always been engineered to handle that. But I run the MX-5 on E5. I've run my other classic cars on E5. But generally speaking, I've never tended to find a problem with filling up with E5. But even if you're in your classic car and you're in the Highlands of Scotland or, somewhere remote in the West Country, perhaps, and you just need to get some petrol to get you somewhere. If you put a tenner's worth of E10 in your tank, it's not going to wreck your fuel systems. It's just a case of put it through. Next time you get to a petrol station that does have E5, then top it up. It's generally speaking, that's not going to cause you any problems. But where we have found issues, and certainly I found this with my Reliant Scimitar, is if you are running a car around on E10, which and you can find this with E5 over time as well, as it tends to eat away at things like fuel lines and things like that. So it's just worth checking your fuel lines to make sure that you haven't got sort of ethanol related degradation.
It's not too bad if you've had sort of a recent restoration or recent overhaul on your fuel system, because the modern sort of rubbers, modern plastics that make up the fuel lines
is if you've got older kits more on it, resilient.
Yeah, older pieces, older fuel filters, if you've got the old sort of plastic bowl fuel filters or the paper filter element inside it, if it sits for a long time, so if it's a car that you're going to park up over winter, that's where you start to get a few of those issues. Often it's either recommended you completely drain the tank or completely brim it with E5 because it's less likely to absorb water, less likely to degrade those lines when sat for a longer period of time. If it's a classic that you use every day in the same way that you or I use like Toyota and our Suzuki, or if in the summer when I'm using the MG when I fixed it, generally speaking, it will sort of blow through a tank of E10 without any problems. And because it's constantly flowing through, it's not sitting there, it's not getting a chance to constantly sort of eat away at fuel fittings. It's a bit more of a sort of a viable option. But if it's a car that you use on a less regular basis, that investment in E5 goes a long way.
It's pennies as a pump, isn't it? Per litre.
It doesn't make a huge amount of sort of difference over the cost of a tank.
And don't forget as well, if you fill it with E5, it generally does a little bit more to the gallon anyway. I found that with my cars. I have run the Toyota on E5 before, and it generally gets a little bit more to the gallon. It's not it's not enough to offset the extra cost, but it helps.
I never write it all down, and I've never had a long enough run to get a sense of fuel economy in the Mini. I use E5. just like what you were mentioning there about, you know, when you do come to lay your car up, I never know when I'm going to lay my car up. It's very much weather dependent, and I'm never really quite sure when it is that's going to be that sort of thing, and it's going to be sort of spend a few weeks sat in the garage. So I think it's always reassuring to know that I use the E5, I use the lead additive as well, and yeah, just gives that peace of mind sort of thing. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to check for degradation or things like that, but it just means that I know that I've done everything I can do sort of thing. So, and yeah, as I say, I don't do anywhere close to the mileage in the minute that you guys do in the gym and the events sort of thing. So yeah.
I mean, I think the real acid test is going to be when I fire up the MG for the first time with its rebuilt engine in it, because that's been sitting since September with E5 in the tank. So I think my first sort of port of call is going to be to the petrol station, brim some jerry cans with E5 and sort of dilute the tank and dilute the system to give it as better chance as possible, perhaps even sort of run it, because it's it's pump on the block, so I might sort of try and pump through the line just to bring a load of fresh through before I even sort of get close to putting it through the pump. But yeah, I think it's one of those things that you can never be too cautious, because ultimately it will cost a bit more at the pump to buy the E5, but that's a hell of a lot cheaper than replacing your entire fuel system. It's sort of one of those sort of sunk cost fallacies of where you make that decision. But with the fact that it's going to be sticking around, or we're in a positive point that should it come to
I think it's in a good place. But again, the message with all of these things is that you should use it or lose it, essentially. If everybody stopped using it tomorrow and they all started putting E10, it would disappear, because there wouldn't be the demand for it. Mm.
But it's one of those things that there's a healthy market for it, which is what we want to see. Although we'll say, from a sound engineer's point of view, talking about a lot of petrol and pump, the spikes on the sound graph for this have been absurd. Anyway, if you don't like listening to plosives, we'll move on. And from keeping fuel on the forecourts to dealing with fuel rationing, we're marking the 80th anniversary of VE Day in this issue, with a feature on the wartime cars that kept Britain and its armed forces moving through the conflict. And there are some brilliant choices and stories in the spread that we've got, but a favourite of mine has to be the Ford WOA2.
I knew you were going to pick that.
I love a chunky SUV, and there's a brilliant note on the user guide for it stating that no amount of engineering ingenuity could take the place of reasonable attention and avoidance of misuse, because it brought me back to a brilliant story that I'd read. I recently read the brilliant book by Ben McIntyre, SAS Rogue Heroes, The History of the British Armed Forces. Misusing vehicles is a long one. And the best example has to be their improvised tactical, the Blitz Buggy, which was a decapitated Ford station wagon fitted with all manner of armaments, including Vickers machine guns. And this thing limped about the desert, providing a brilliant means of fast entry and fast escape for the nascent unit with long-range petrol tanks and a sun compass. But it sort of brought me back to that brilliant, weird, quirky piece of history. I was like, I love that sort of just make it work, very resilient engineering that sort of was sparked through this period of time. And we got things like those Fords, we got the giant Dodge wagons and things that were used by sort of the Allied forces. It's really quite a fun bit of sort of engineering and Ford vehicle history.
Absolutely. And the really interesting thing is, obviously, when Britain, you know, entered the Second World War, it's worth remembering that the Willys Jeep was still another 2 years away. You know, the Land Rovers, which obviously formed such a big part of Britain's armed forces, that was still another 9 years away. That didn't arrive until 1948. So actually, Britain's motor industry, they turned to some of their really big selling cars, you know, things like the Hillman Minx, the Austin 10, cars like that. And it was a case of very much make, do, and mend. And these vehicles were adapted. You know, we talk about sort of the conversion by the armed forces into use as Tillys as well. Certainly 29,000 Austin 10s were turned into Tillys during the course of the conflict. And actually, these were really big selling cars in the late 30s. And through, you know, some real ingenuity, these cars were turned into cars that actually played a real part in the war effort. And that's, you know, worth remembering, you know, during this sort of very poignant anniversary this week.
I mean, it's testament to sort of manufacturers like Austin. You sort of assume that with the war, just, you know, car manufacturing, it came to a complete halt sort of thing. And to a point it did, you know, certainly the focus became on doing other things, building armaments, building tanks, things like that. But Austin was responsible for sort of building 500 vehicles a week from the tillies that David mentioned to sort of 3-ton trucks that we use for everything, sort of ambulances to firefighting to all sorts of things. So yeah, I think it demonstrated that time, the incredible flexibility, and necessity sort of required them to be that flexible sort of thing, but it still should be celebrated. And I think that's what we were trying to sort of get across. We've got 10 very different sort of cars, and one sort of SUV truck thingy that just sort of shows, what was going on at that time and how these vehicles were used, definitely used. It wasn't just not necessarily on the front lines, but as very much part of the war effort.
I mean, necessity is the mother of all invention, I think, is the sort of a common phrase. And the sort of British motoring industry was great to sort of grapple onto that idea and just go, well, we produce these things, paint it green, give it some knobblier tyres, and away we go. We've sort of got a bit of a very quick and very easy and very affordable solution that could be made with the bare minimum sort of requirements, and also didn't really require making new cars. A lot of it was cars they already had sort of sitting on colts and lots ready to go that they were able to sort of alter and sort of basically go, here you go, here's a load of cars ready to go. This was sort of the brilliant thing, if we'd been producing these relatively utilitarian and practical cars to begin with that didn't take a huge amount of alteration to sort of suit military purpose. I don't know if any of you have got favorite choices from the spread that we put together.
I think for me, the Hillman Minx is the one that sort of stands out to me again, because it was used sort of by lots of different members of the armed forces for all sorts of different duties. It was very versatile. The thing that strikes me as well about sort of the motor industry during World War II is not only were they converting bestsellers and obviously producing, as Chris mentions, things like armaments and planes and different things to support the armed forces, but actually some of the cars that came out after the war, where as a result of some quite clever thinking during the conflict. So obviously, we've already mentioned the Land Rover that came about because Maurice Wilkes was messing around with an old Second World War II Jeep up in Anglesey. The Jaguar XK120 came about because they were doing work on William Lyons was sort of doing sketches and so on during the conflict, and came up with a lot of the concepts for that car during the conflict. And obviously Rover's involvement with the developments of the jet engine meant that a lot of that sort of innovation in the 1950s came about as a result of their experiences during the conflict.
Well, it's incredible, isn't it, with the XK120. You think it was basically an engine was developed and then a car was done on the fly, and for something so pretty to result from it is quite incredible. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, like Jowett in particular, sort of stands out for me as well. The Javelin, just the forward thinking technologies that were on that car were really sort of something. So a favorite, I like the Vauxhall 14J type, again for very similar reasons to David. It's just a very utilitarian sort of car that continued in production sort of after the war, before sort of Luton took a different approach to things. So I think it has that sort of 1940s style as well that really sort of appeals. So yeah, I think we've not sort of written this piece in terms of a go out and buy these cars, but I think it's easy to sort of overlook 1940s cars as being practical. Yes, they require a little bit more care and attention sort of thing, but compared to 50s and 60s cars, they're not that disparate, and they are certainly cars that you can use for the hobby, for going to car shows, things like that. I wouldn't say every day, take a brave soul, but yeah, don't overlook these cars. Don't think of them as museum pieces. You know, they are absolutely worthy as classics.
I think they get sort of, they do get celebrated every now and then, but they can do with sort of an additional celebration outside of sort of things that go on to actively celebrate World War II, sort of military celebrations. You look at, there's always sort of the military camp at Vista Heritage, which always, because obviously it was an active airbase. Goodwood Revival is great for sort of celebrating that period through history, but I think it's nice to support these cars beyond simply a case of nostalgia for, or I say nostalgia in the sort of looser sense for World War II, or certainly sort of the vehicles and the sort of engineering that came from it. Is worth sort of remembering these cars. Things like the Hillman Humber Pullman as well is a really unique vehicle to have come out at that time. You don't think that the sort of development of limousines or sort of large luxury saloon cars is really going to have come from that point, but
as an it's the amount of torque yeah. that they have, and that's not something you're going to overlook, you know, for transporting people and making sure that you can get those people to the particular sort of the senior personnel to where they need to be. Yeah, you can't overlook those vehicles, yeah. can you?
When it comes to sort of ferrying important people about the place, there was a lot of that, as obviously for America, the UK served as very much a forward operating base. We had a huge amount of sort of foreign dignitaries coming through the country for sort of important meetings at the time that need to be going from sort of airfields to be sort of brought in and out to the centre of London and sort of far-reaching places where these meetings are happening. And they were needed car, as well as obviously staff cars for sort of senior sort of military personnel to sort of buzz about the place as well. So it's a brilliant piece of history. And again, it's one of those things that I love about classic cars, is the fact they're so intrinsically linked to sort of social history as well. It's the way that you can sort of look and piece together the things that were going on in the fabric of society at the time based on the cars and how they were being used.
Absolutely.
But that's sort of one of the many pieces we've got included in this week's issue. Obviously, there is a quick preview for the With All Meets, which are returning later this month, third Sunday in May.
Yeah, so we've kind of already had a dry run for it on Drive It Day with quite a big meet. They had their biggest turnout yet, which was 205 cars, which I thought was a fantastic result. It's the biggest one they've had so far. But again, we will be returning on the 18th of May. Our good friend and managing editor, James Sadlier, is going to be there with his VW Polo, so he'll be showing that off. But again, come along, free to take part if you're driving a classic, and it's a really good day out. You know, obviously you can feast your eyes on old buses and coaches, for hours. But obviously there's a good, great coffee, bacon butty, chance to sort of take the kids out as well, and just a really good, nice opportunity just to get up early, have a brew, and just chat with people about all the cars they brought along.
You're never sure what's going to park next to you. I think that's something to really sort of underline. I've only been to one. I will get to another one this year. But yeah, it's just the selection of cars that were there, sort of thing, spanning all eras. You're never quite sure what it is that's going to be next year. It was an XK140 in my case, and another Mark 1 Mini sort of thing. So, but yeah, looking around, there really is, there's going to be something that you're going to be interested in.
It always sparks a sort of a nice conversation as well. You get talking to so many different people. Obviously, we've sort of across the events, we'll have different staff from Classic Car Weekly there as well, sort of having a good chat as well. But even just sort of amongst the sort of the punters that turn up and the readers that turn up, it's some fantastic stories you uncover of sort of long-term ownership and sort of work undertaken on these cars. It's a nice sort of way to sort of feel part of the community and sort of get out and enjoy it, which is always well rewarded. Elsewhere in the issue, we've got 50 years of the Volkswagen Golf GTI. Obviously, as we sort of go through its troubled nascence, it goes through our Classic 5 trials, and plenty of other bits and pieces to enjoy, including a buying guide for the Ford Cortina Mark 4 and the 80. So plenty to enjoy in this week's issue. Next week, I can't remember what I look forward to next week.
Oh, gosh. No, next week, Jaguar XJS.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, of course.
Jaguar XJS.
Yeah.
That's a big moment in the sun.
Gosh, it's that long ago that I did it now. Apologies. As people may be aware, it is the 50th anniversary of the Jaguar XJS. Came along in September. We've jumped the gun slightly on the slightly tenuous fact that journalists had their first sneak peek of the XJS in May 1975. You were there with me. So we were trying out three different body styles, three different running gears, I think is probably the better way to put it, sort of thing. So this is all thanks to the Jaguar Daimler Heritage Trust. They afford us access to three incredible cars. So I won't spoil things, but they have some absolutely fantastic provenance, completely unique in every way, in their own ways as well. We were able to sort of drive them. I know that Jesse and I definitely have our firm favourite from that particular shoot, but we will we'll touch on that next week, definitely.
Yes, so plenty to look forward to in the coming issue, which we ought to get back to our desks and get back to putting together. So that leaves with little more to do than thank both of you for joining us this morning. David, thank you.
Thank you.
And Chris.
Thank you very much.
And like we said, we'll be back next week with another edition of the Classic Car Weekly podcast, and importantly, another issue of Classic Car Weekly.